welcome to Charity Chat. I'm your host, Rachel Conway. The issues raised in this week's episode may be distressing or triggering for some of our listeners, as we sat down with Lana Muirmayer, Innovation Manager at Action for Children, to discuss her life and journey into the charity sector. As we begin the conversation focusing on her youth, Lana opens up about her time spent being homeless and growing up in a household of domestic violence. As we continue to learn more about her career path in adulthood, we hear about some of the negative experiences she had trying to migrate into the charity sector and how she thinks the sector can be better at recruiting and welcoming employees from a more diverse range of backgrounds. This episode of Charity Chat has been brought to you by our platinum sponsor, Work for Good. Work for Good is a fundraising platform helping businesses raise funds for charities through their sales. The platform makes the legal agreement needed for businesses to fundraise themselves quick and simple, saving charities time and resource and enabling them to raise more unrestricted income. Pop to www.workforgood.co.uk to learn more and to book a free demo. Here is Lana. Hi there, everyone. I'm very happy today to be joined by Lana Muirmayer, Innovation Manager at Action for Children, to tell us more about her life and career today. How are you today, Lana?
I'm good, thank you. How are you?
I'm great. For the listener, Lana has a very fun top on. So we did have a bit of a discussion about that before we hit record today.
Yeah, it's a Star Wars t-shirt from about 2001. And Rachel's been the only person who noticed that it was Scar, not Star. So I was quite impressed.
Great. Thanks, Lana. Well, yeah, if it's okay with you, I'd love to start at the beginning. Are you happy to share with our listeners a bit about your youth today?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm super open about it. I think that when someone meets me, I do overshare. So now will not be any different, I suppose. I'm trying to think of how to put this. I'm basically an army brat. Both parents were in the army, and then lived in Germany for quite some time. I'm one of three. And the reason I think that that's quite important is that my brother and sister play quite a big part in my youth, because my sister is disabled. Mm-hmm. She has a genetic chromosome deletion, 22q11. And my brother had meningitis when he was less than a year old. Okay. So he has some residual kind of impacts of being quite ill when he was so young. Grew up on an army base for a little bit. Then we kind of moved into the traditional council flat environment when you come out of that. And then my parents had quite a heated marriage, I think is the best way of putting it. We were the recipients of quite a lot of support from charities growing up.
Okay.
So we did have a little kind of stint in a domestic abuse kind of environment where we moved up to Manchester for a little bit. But as many women do, she went back to him. And then finally, he did leave. And he actually went and married my sister's teacher. So that was interesting. Mum didn't take it very well, as you can imagine. She became very, very ill. So she was on her own, three kids. We lived in Hastings. And she didn't eat. She didn't move. She quite often just lay on the sofa all day, every day. Usually smoked a lot of cigarettes because she wasn't eating. And so I was the kind of poor, impoverished kids at school. We were on benefits. Like I said, she didn't work. And so, yeah, it was an interesting environment. So to help out the family, I then went to work at 15. And I worked in what used to be called a Dillon's store. And I used to work from about 6 a.m. in the morning until 8:30, then go to school, and then come back from school at about 4-ish and then work through till 10.
Wow.
And yeah, it was interesting. But you know, I brought some money in. It was really, really good. My mum, as the money kind of started coming in, started to get a little bit better. But some other stuff that basically happened was what's quite, again, traditional, I think, and quite common is I had very, very high expectations put on me. My sister was ill. My brother was quite a handful as well. My grades had to be very, very high, and I developed an eating disorder.
Okay.
And mum really, really struggled with it because she had a disabled child and she had everything else that was happening. And basically that ended up with quite a, it was interesting because she didn't really ever go out for any help because it was quite an embarrassment to her having a child, which was first of all, very, very, very fat, which was a massive embarrassment to her because I shouldn't be fat because that's just not acceptable.
Okay.
And then I lost all the weight. And then she was very, very, very proud that I was very thin. But I was thin in the wrong way.
Mm.
And then that became an embarrassment. And it all basically came to a head where she took me down to the council, said that I was too much and she didn't want me anymore. And we had a meeting where we had a social worker and a council worker, and they basically said, well, we're going to have to somehow mediate between you two. We went for a couple of sessions, then NCH got involved, which now is Action for Children. And it just kept on rolling, kept on getting more aggressive. And she wrote a letter of estrangement back then, which says that I don't want her. And it all culminated with throwing me out, basically. Went to live with my dad for a little bit. That did not go well. He asked me to au pair for my aunt for bed and board. No money. So I ran away from there, back to Hastings. I got put in a bed and breakfast, which actually housed mainly sex offenders. And the door didn't lock. So I had to sleep in a suitcase against the door to make sure that I wouldn't have anyone come in. And then a friend's mum, who was lovely, let me stay with her for a couple of days. But because of the way it works, if I have somewhere to stay, they won't rehouse me. So I had to go back to the bed and breakfast. And then the Christian Hostel Association stepped in, gave me somewhere to live. And then NCH did like loads of support stuff with me. So that's basically my youth. But you know,
there's
lots of stuff as well.
Okay. Well, Lana, I think that is so much for someone to go through. How old were you when all this happened? You mentioned you were 15 when you started working at the Dillons. What's the kind of timeline of all of this?
Yeah. So they got divorced when I was about 7 or 8. And I remember listening the other day to somebody who was just like, well, surely divorces don't take that long in the 90s and things. But they didn't have the whole kind of no-fault divorce back then. And it took them about, I think it was 5 years to get divorced. So by that point, I was around about 13. And at that point, my mum's health just absolutely bottomed out and declined. She had nothing left. She was poor, like, thing, just couldn't do it anymore. And so around about 13, I started to kind of overeat massively. And then I got to about 20 stone-ish, and that was not good as far as she was concerned. And then about 15, 16, I started working in Dillon's. 16, I went and worked in a factory, and I got the mickey taken out of me a little bit too much. I saw a particular film that gave me a blow-by-blow advice, basically, on how to do what I was doing, eating disorders-wise. I don't think the film would be released now. And from about 16 to 17, I lost about, oh, I think it was about 10 stone-ish, maybe more actually, because I think at my lightest, I was around about 8 stone. So and then just after 16, when I was doing my A-levels, mum went, I can't do this anymore, you've got to go. So she had a lot, to be fair, she did have a lot. And it kind of, when people asked me about it at the time, her view on it was that my illness was self-imposed, and my brother and sisters wasn't. So, yeah, I was pretty open to it. And to be honest, it was not a happy environment.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, but still so much to go through by the age of essentially 17 in that sense, Lana. And, yeah, thank you for being so honest. It's, you know, you said at the start that you're an open book, but I think it's really important that stories like this are shared. And just the fact that you were doing your A-levels, you know, you'd taken that step to take yourself into further education as well,
it just adds another kind of layer to the whole piece, doesn't it, of what you were kind of balancing all at once at that time as well.
I was super academic as well. I loved my studies. I absolutely adored it. I did really well in my GCSEs, not as well as some of my friends, because I did have the very intelligent kind of group of friends. Five of my friends got 9 A stars. I did not. Like, absolutely, I didn't. I was considered, you're like, the, one of the least intelligent out of that group by far, which is fine. I was average. But I really enjoyed studies. And so I think when all of this kind of kicked off, I couldn't focus because I wasn't eating, so which didn't help. But I remember this is going to be a really sad moment. I do apologize. I did my philosophy A level or AS level. I did my religious study AS level. They went fine. And then I sat down to do my biology AS level, and I knew I was getting thrown out like the day before or something. And I just wrote my name in the top of the paper and just cried. And I got a U because I was like, well, yeah, I got a U. But I remember somebody walking around and going, can you be quiet? Like, shh, there's other people doing their exam. I was like, okay, just got crying there. But yeah, when they read out the paper, what I got, my dad read the grade to me and he was like, you. And he just looked so disappointed. And I was like, yeah, I just cried. As if I couldn't do it.
I mean, just the fact that you even turned up and were sitting there, I think, is something as an adult you probably are very proud of. But yeah, no, thanks for sharing again. This that kind of your love of studying, I guess, moves us on nicely to how your career path has progressed and what led you to your current role at Action for Children, which actually has had a little shout out as well in your youth in that sense.
Yeah, it was absolutely essential. So Action for Children, which was National Children's Homes, and another charity called Extracts, which I'm now a trustee for, those two charities were pretty much pivotal in keeping myself and about 15, 20 other people in the same situation alive. They really, really, really were. And it was just silly little things like, well, silly little things, but providing a washing machine and stuff like that, which, yeah, just doesn't isn't as much seen now. But the kind of career path went from so I dropped out of the sixth form college. It just wasn't a possibility. I couldn't do A levels. It just wasn't there. When I moved into the hostel, you're not allowed to work because the price of kind of like keeping you in the hostel is covered by housing benefit, but you can't meet that yourself because it's thousands of pounds. And so you're not allowed to work. So the only option you've got is you've got to go to college, but I couldn't afford to go to college. So I had to drop out. So I was in this kind of weird limbo where it's like, I'm gonna have to think of something else to do. And so Action for Children had a at NCH had a particular program on which they were doing like an arts subject with keep putting on workshops and things. And the idea was is that if you got selected, you and some other people would be put on at a show at the Tate. And so I did all that. I put all my work in. There was a great support worker in there helping me do a portfolio, putting that together. I got up to the Tate. I was part of the exhibition. And then I used that portfolio work to get into art college. So I completely switched from doing philosophy, religious studies, chemistry, human biology to doing fine art, just because it was the only thing I could do that was acceptable or available to me. And then when I got my flat, I was able to work again, but which I think they've changed now, you automatically get the debt because they pay it in arrears. I automatically got the debt come over, which meant I was £500 in debt as soon as I started working. So I then had to work around about 35 hours a week to then go to college. And then wonderfully, I got into uni after that. I met my partner who I'm with now at college. We're still together. And then I went to uni in Chichester, then went and worked for City College Brighton as an administrator, went and was a project manager at an e-learning company. And then I worked for another charity called Culture 24, which was amazing. They were so kind, so lovely. Then I became a freelancer. Then I decided to go into teaching because it was an unbelievable decision. And then I came out of teaching about a year ago after 8 years in teaching, and now I'm at Action for Children.
Wow, yeah, I mean
Yeah.
that first bit is is amazing. I think the thing to hold on to there is, you know, how important so many services are to young people that were in a similar position to you, but not just the services, as well making sure that as many people as possible are aware of how to access these services, which I know is quite often a disconnect with organizations that are getting to those young people as well.
So as I mentioned, I'm a trustee for Extracts now, and we just moved into a new building, and we tried out this kind of hub and spoke model for ages, where we went out to the young people to go and see what they needed in the positions they were in. And I had a bit of a concern that I didn't think that method would work, because it's not the method that I would have wanted. But I also have to kind of step back from that and say, I'm not 17 anymore. I'm 39. The times have most certainly changed. But it's kind of leaning to the post-COVID, kind of like during COVID times, everything, getting people into particular areas was difficult, so we had to go to them. But it's starting to come around now with like the cost of living and people needing to relate to each other, that they are kind of tending to come back to shared spaces. And so we've just moved. We've moved in with a number of other charities who are going to share the space with us and hopefully share the individuals that we need to provide services to as well, so that they don't have to go to multiple places. We've all come to them, hopefully.
That does make sense. Thanks, Anna. And thinking about, you said you left teaching about a year ago now. Did you face any challenges transitioning from teaching into the charity sector?
Oh, my goodness. Yes. I had issues transferring from private sector into teaching. It was just, they say that they want transferable skills and they want industry professionals and everything, which they do, and definitely the students do, but they don't want them to bring any ideas of expectation on treatment and any ideas or expectation on salary, most certainly not. It's an interesting industry, and I taught in the FE sector, so I think like secondary teaching and everything is a bit different. And I also taught HE. They're just not set up for, they need their structure. They need the ways that kind of like things are done in specific manners in order to safeguard and also to ensure that everything is consistent, which just doesn't really resonate that well with the private sector. But it has done me loads of good to transfer into the charity sector, which is not as fast moving as private, sometimes, not always, depending on the size of the charity. But there are certain things you do for certain reasons, which work in their certain way, because that's what funders need. That's what the safeguarding, person, their welfare, ensuring that, we're upholding our values and, that the aims and objectives, and we're all moving towards the same kind of direction. So that teaching prepared me for really, really well. But when it came to getting into charity, it was so hard. It was so, so, so hard. And I think, honestly, my CV with the jumping, with the kind of the gap in my education where I was, homeless, with my quite low first degree marks. I went and did another one because I was so embarrassed with it. All of these things kind of snowballed into me on paper looking not like a very good option. And you don't write on your CV, I have got lived experience of exactly what you deal with. You kind of hope to put that in your covering letter. But quite often I feel that the covering letter doesn't get read. It's the CV that goes through, potentially an external resourcing agency, and then by that point you're out, you're lost. So I applied coming out of teaching for over 200 jobs, and about 35 to 50 of those were in the charity industry. And I think 3 responded to me and just acknowledged me at all. And it was brutal. One interview in particular that I had was just, I knew that when I was having the interview, I loved the charity and I still love the charity and I really, really value what they do. But the way I was treated in the interview and everything was just, I don't want to work here. Like, I just don't. I it was so unpleasant. And the feedback I got back, which was, it took me 4 months to get from application to rejection. I did two presentations, and at the very last minute, they said, we'll call you on X day. And as you do, where it comes to around about 4 o'clock, you're like, I've definitely not got it. If I got it, they would have called me in the morning, no problem. But I'm waiting, and I'm waiting for that kind of moment of respect for a phone call back. And they emailed me at 5:02 on a Friday. And I remember it really well, because in the bottom of this letter, this feedback they gave, which was just brutal, ripping apart of my personality, it said, you think that you're making a difference in the organization that you're in, but you're not making any real change. And I just
wow.
Like, oh, like, yeah, absolutely. Good Lord, kind of thing. But yeah, it was, I just didn't expect that from a charity. I just thought they'd be more aware, but obviously they're massively overworked, but I just did not. It was this kind of thing where teaching had just been so brutal and so long, and the hours had been so hideous, that I just thought I was going into this very kind, intrinsically environment, and it just did not happen that way. I went for another interview with a different charity, again, very, very valued, and I really do like them. And the woman who interviewed me was exhausted as soon as she came into the interview. She was battered. And I hadn't been asked to do anything. So I sent an email saying, hi, do you need me to do anything? Mm-hmm. Silence. I sent a follow-up saying, are you sure you don't need me to do anything? Silence. So I turned up and they went, okay, so now you can do your presentation. I went, I haven't got a presentation. I did. And I like, and you have that awkward moment. You're like, I'm going to have to tell you that I've messaged you. I'm like, this is not going to look good on me, because I'm going to have to now highlight. And I was like, I'm really sorry, but if you give me an hour, I'll put something together. No worries. And she says, okay, there's no issue. And so she was really great. She goes, tell you what, you can do your presentation tomorrow. You can have the whole day. And then I got an email. I got an email or so a bit later that says, do you know what? Don't worry about it. We've decided not to pursue this role at all. So everybody's been told no. And it was just, oh, there's got a moment where you just go, oh, and just you're waiting for that interview. And so those two were awful. But then I had the interview actually with children. And as soon as I came in, can I name check them? Okay.
Yeah.
So Martin Wilson and Jessica Taylor Khan were just amazing. From the moment I stepped in, it was just full of kindness. They were really upbeat. They were talking about how excited they were to see me, and about how they kind of pulled out little bits from my application, as in like, oh, I saw that you said this. I'm really looking forward to how you explaining further about that. And it was just interview 101, but on kind of empathy steroids, mm-hmm. as it were. It was just so lovely. And as soon as I stepped into that interview and came out, I was like, that's where I want to work.
Yeah.
Which was such a breath of fresh air. And they told me within 24 hours whether I got the job or not. And some of the jobs that I went for didn't tell me within 2 weeks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I mean, yeah, some not very pleasant stories there along the way, but I think it sounds like you landed in a place where it was the right fit for you, and in a space that you feel confident and comfortable as well, which I think is always really important.
Yeah, I have. I think if I didn't have, and this is going to sound like a small violin moment, if I didn't have the past I have, I think I'd be much more comfortable. With when you've kind of like got care experienced kind of issues, you do end up with, again, imposter syndrome out of the ears kind of thing. And there is a constant fear that they're going to let you go, and mm-hmm. that this is going to end, and that you'll go back to what you were doing. And any kind of feedback that you get is usually personalized, but they are really, really good at managing me in that respect. But I think it's because, yeah, they do have so much experience of it, because they deal with fostering and care experience youths and stuff. So yeah, it is good.
Yeah. And for whatever reason, I know there are different bodies and different individuals trying to change it. The charity sector is still incredibly middle class in the kind of the overall, you know, demographic of the people that are working there.
Yeah, absolutely. My when I have my appraisals with my boss, the one thing I always bring up is my ability to communicate with my peers.
Mm.
And that I am struggling to network, and I am struggling to find common ground with people, and that I can feel the tone change if I say something that's a little bit risque or something, or I kind of push an envelope too far. And I am definitely overly sensitive to it, but I have to really look for like an in with someone, and that's in just everyday conversation, to be fair. But at work, I do think it is possibly a little bit worse because I'm so invested in work. And I think, again, I was thinking when I approached you with this and you sent me the questions over, I was thinking about it a lot when it comes to why I take it so seriously, which I know you should with work. But losing money or losing a job is so dramatic when you don't have that safety net of family. Yeah. That it's just like the smallest thing of feedback, which is like, Lana, you could improve this. It's like, oh my God, they hate me. And what am I going to do? And now they're going to find someone else, and somebody else is much better at my job, and I'm never going to get a pay rise. And oh my God. And it's just like, let's de-escalate that conversation slightly in your own head. Yeah. But I do enjoy it.
Oh, well, no, that is good. And yeah, like, I think it is interesting, and it's, I think the sector needs to hear more voices like yours, and potentially it's not always the obvious things that someone might think of someone coming from a different background to the majority of employees of that organisation. It can be things which you may not, other people might not think of, like you said, on that kind of common ground on the day-to-day interaction. That is something that probably I haven't even thought of myself. So even for me to hear that, I think it's interesting, and I hope our listeners kind of can take stuff from that as well.
It's the tiny little microaggression-y things, which, you know, all things considered, I'm in an incredibly privileged position. I'm very aware of the benefits that I have within society. I may have started a little bit more humbly, but I have got things working for me which other people don't benefit from. So I play hockey, which is an incredibly privileged environment. We cannot lie about that. I love it, but it is very privileged. And in my old hockey club, there was about 400 young women who play. It's 200, apologies. But out of the 200 young women who play, only 3 of them go to state school. The rest all go to private. And I was having a conversation with one of the dads about it. And I said, oh, you know, like, it's very different than when I was growing up. Hockey was absolutely integral to keeping me kind of connected to kids off the council estate quite often, which was quite important. So I was talking to him about it and I was explaining it. And he said, well, that's all fine, but what about the normal kids? And it was just that moment going, oh yes, I know. I'm trash, I guess. thanks. It was quite sweet, but at the same time, But the other end as well, I left that hockey club because of a conversation in the end where I was asking for some help on something. I didn't want to disclose exactly why I was struggling. It was a particularly triggering event. And the person I was asking for the help from said, how am I supposed to help you if you won't give me the background of why you need this help? So it's like I said before, I'm a bit of an oversharer, but there are these kind of lines that I draw for myself where I go, okay, I go from being open to being vulnerable.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, I don't need to give you that information. And I think as soon as you do, like, I'll say something off the cuff, like somebody goes, oh, I'm going home for Christmas. And I'll say, oh, cool, I'm going to my husband's for Christmas. Do you go there every year? Yes, I do. Do you not want to see your parents? Well, this kind of moment. And just the silence in that room, and you're like, oh, it's fine, it's absolutely fine. But it's that, and just that person looking at, oh, crumbs, why? And you're like, no, don't ask why, just like, pull it back a bit. You don't need to know why. You think, well, there was this whole situation, just, you know.
No, that is interesting, and it kind of leads into what we're going to talk about a bit about what you think some of the problems that are still facing young people who may find themselves homeless today, like you did yourself, that may not be immediately obvious to our listeners?
I have got, so my gears are ground very hard on this particular area, being an ex-teacher, because I went into teaching to, especially at FE level, because that is the really kind of formative time for all of these problems, all of the hormones, all of the kind of relationship dynamics and things like that kind of coming to a head. The stresses and strains between parents and their kids is really hot. And I think the mess that is education, especially at FE at the moment, is infuriating. So just a few examples. Okay, just the instability of teachers. So we would have supply all the time. And I speak to loads of people, loads of teachers are going off on sick. They're obviously on strike at the moment, and rightly so, and a number of things. But every time that the teachers or the supply come in, it's another set of eyes on this person that needs to be watched and who's vulnerable and who needs to, are they washing? Are they, you know, are they wearing the same clothes still? Yeah. Are they, you know, are they kind of getting quite quiet? Are they getting inappropriate in classes? Are they shouting? And you can't track those kids because they've got no stability or consistency. Then the other thing, which I find absolutely explosive, is the unrealistic expectations set on some young people. So around about 50% achieve both English and maths. And if they don't achieve English and maths, then they'll have to do it over and over and over and over again until they do it. And it, every time they try it again, it's around about 20 to 30% chances of achieving it the next time and the next time. The damage that does to the mental health of a young person, especially if they have no home, they just won't come in. They don't enjoy it. It's not a safe space. It's not an enjoyable space. Their friends are going, oh, you've still not passed it. It's embarrassing. And it's just not that kind of, they've got nowhere to live. Educational college is meant to be their safe zone. And it's becoming really quite conflict driven for them. So then, that annoys me. The introduction of A levels versus T levels has driven me spare because there is generally, I was the exception to the rule of all my friends who were in the hostel with me. I could do A levels now because I'd have both my English and maths and a number of other things. But if you don't have the grades, you have to do a vocational qualification. And if you have to do a vocational qualification, you have to pick one option of the line that you're going to go down. And then on top of that, if you pick a vocational qualification which is expensive, so like I was teaching in a land-based college for a while, and chainsaw trousers are £100 to £200. If you don't have chainsaw trousers, you cannot do forestry or arboriculture.
Yeah, okay.
Blacksmithing is about 250, I think. You can't do it. So kids who do not have a home to go to, or parents with some money, are then forced into these subjects which don't cost anything, and so they're not living up to their potential. They're living up to the potential that they can afford to live up to. And then you've got the whole technology thing of, if they don't have data and they don't have a computer, then obviously they won't achieve as highly, but they also don't have the same social kind of connections. So if they're homeless and they don't have any mobile, then they're alone, they're completely isolated. So some of these things really drive me insane.
No, and I think it's good to, the first step for a lot of people, I think, will be, as I said, like considering the things that you may not think of immediately. And I definitely think, Lana, you've brought up some things there, particularly that kind of the vocational skills is interesting. So I hope our listeners can kind of think about that more when they're thinking about young people who are vulnerable and or homeless or both and potentially at risk there. It's been a great chat. I feel I could ask you a million more questions, Lana, but I think we've probably got time for one more, and I think it'd be really good to get your opinions on how the charity sector could be more supportive and inclusive in its recruitment.
I would say that they need to be more trauma informed. and a trauma-informed approach. And that goes for absolutely everyone. You're not going to know what anyone's going through, and you're not going to know what somebody's life experience has been. So from application to induction to appraisal, be trauma-informed, watch for the microaggressions potentially. Transparency, communication, kind language, and empathy, like the whole thing. Yeah. And some people, especially if they've had lived experience of an environment where they've constantly been fighting for everything, are going to be a lot more passionate about things. So giving people the opportunity to just step back and apologize from a lapse, it's not unprofessional. It is just being kind of adaptive to someone's needs.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a really succinct way of putting it. And I hope that, yeah, a lot of people will think about that in their own recruitment and how we can kind of work together for the sector as well.
Thank you so much for having me. No. For my little kind of, there's my life, enjoy.
No, thank you. Thank you, Lada. It's been absolutely wonderful. And, you know, we would love to welcome you back if there's ever anything else you'd like to talk about as well.
Oh, I'd love to do it again. Thank you so much. Brilliant.
Thanks, Lada. Bye.
Right, cheers. Bye.
Big thank you to Lana for being so frank and open when sharing her personal story with us. Listening to Lana made me think about my own potential unconscious bias and how I interact with those around me. A lot of us enter the sector with genuine intentions to be a force for good, but do we always hold these up? Language and tone can have a big impact in conversations with colleagues and potential future colleagues. Peers can espouse microaggressions when talking to those from different backgrounds to themselves, and interviewers can create a negative experience which is not conducive to getting the most out of the candidates. Learning how we can all be more trauma-informed in our interpersonal relationships at work could be a step to make the sector feel even more inclusive. This should also flow through to organisations' recruitment policies to appeal to a wider range of candidates. Kindness and empathy should be part of our everyday interactions, not an afterthought, in order for us to continue progressing for a truly inclusive sector. So thank you for listening to Charity Chat. If you've been affected by any of the issues raised in this episode, there are a number of helplines for both those experiencing domestic abuse and youth homelessness. Organisations such as Refuge and Women's Aid can support those suffering at the hands of domestic abuse, but also give guidance to anyone who might be worried about someone else. Lana's current organisation, Action for Children, can help provide practical care for those experiencing youth homelessness. Plus, organisations such as Centrepoint can also provide support. I would love to hear your thoughts on this episode. You can find us on Twitter or LinkedIn and share your thoughts. Or you can email us on charitychatpodcast@gmail.com. Please do also like and subscribe to the podcast so you never miss an episode, and share with any colleagues or friends who may be interested. It's just left for me to thank our corporate sponsors. This episode of Charity Chat has been brought to you by our platinum sponsor, Work for Good. Work for Good is a fundraising platform helping businesses raise funds for charities through their sales. The platform makes the legal agreement needed for businesses to fundraise themselves quick and simple, saving charities time and resource and enabling them to raise more unrestricted income. I'd also like to thank Magda Askamit for our beautiful website. Check it out at charitychat.org.uk. Forest of Fools for playing throughout the show and for playing us out now. I've been your host, Rachel Conroy. Thank you again for listening.